TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Norman Solomon, War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. Massachusetts Peace Action invited the author Norman Solomon to a book talk on July 19, 2023. Susan Mirsky is introducing him.
It is my absolute pleasure to introduce Norman Solomon. He is an American journalist, media critic, author, and activist. He is the founder of the Institute for Public Accuracy. He is the co-founder and national director of the online organization RootsAction.org, which I hope all of you tune in on. He's here tonight to talk about his latest book, War Made Invisible. Norman.
Well, many thanks to everybody making our gathering possible here. What I'd like to do is first talk a bit about the information and analysis in the book War Made Invisible, which has just come out in the last few weeks, and then move to the crucial challenges ahead, which is to create the change. I think it's worth reminding ourselves that everything positive about public policy in this country was made possible because people organized. None of it was ever given by the powerful to the less powerful. And so as we look at the current situation, there's often a tendency, certainly from the mass media, to suggest that if we can simply find the right few leaders or support a particular political party, then that is our breakthrough. Nothing in history really indicates that, quite the contrary. There was so much messaging from the mass media, from political figures, to encourage passivity politically, to assume that political action involves voting only and that our voices mean little otherwise. It's a consumer culture. It's a culture treating us, teaching us to be passive. And yet, as AIDS activists said in the 1980s, silence equals death, and never more so than with the nuclear Armageddon shadow hanging over us, arguably more than in any other time in our lifetimes. And yet the denial is extremely powerful. So invisibility and denial go hand in hand. We live in a warfare state. The crimes of the Russian government in Ukraine are self-evident. There's no point in soft peddling or watering down the analysis that there are war crimes being committed by the Russian government every day. At the same time, history, past and present, has to matter. We have to make it matter and put it into a sharp context. It's a roadmap for where we've been, where we are, and the terrain where we've headed. And in this century, the government, by far the most responsible for slaughtering people directly and indirectly through warfare, is the United States of America. That is simply a reality that is filtered out by our mass media. I'd have to say, not all that often mentioned in a lot of corporate or liberal media. It's an inconvenient fact that the warfare state that we live in, propelled by massive profits of corporate capitalism, this is a system that is designed to make profit off of death. We live in a death culture. We used to say, even in the anti-war movement during the Vietnam War, sardonically and angrily, war is profitable, invest your son. And that was also to some degree a fitting statement during the first years of the so-called war on terror, but increasingly the boots on the ground are substituted by high technology, the pretense of being above it all, the tacit belief that somebody with a suicide belt is a terrorist who killed civilians, but somebody who uses a technology from Boeing or Northrop Grumman is the opposite, when in fact the results are largely the same. One of the aspects of War Made Invisible is this pretense that U.S. warfare is somehow humane. This is a way of our society preening ourselves and reassuring ourselves that we're not so terrible after all. And in fact, U.S. militarism has a benign aspect to it, or even benign intentions. And so at the start of the 21st century, there was a lot of talk about responsibility to protect what Noam Chomsky referred to in a 1999 book as the new military humanism. And now the excuses have changed, but the tremendous profiteering of the Pentagon contractors has continued to ratchet upward. Every year, the Pentagon budget, it's not a defense budget, it's lowercase d, often we're told, defense budget. It's never appropriately been called a lowercase d defense budget. It's a military budget. And as it goes through the roof, the bipartisan cheerleading for it continues. As a matter of fact, I note in the book that around the time of the celebration of the Prince of Peace in late December, the presidents, including Biden, ceremoniously sign in the Oval Office the military budget to help kill more people. There's a quote at the beginning of the book from Thomas Merton, and he wrote it concluding a poem in the face of a Nazi commandant. And he wrote, "Do not think yourself better because you burn up friends and enemies with long-range missiles without ever seeing what you have done." What the U.S. warfare state does is to engage in that kind of activity and assure us that these are moral actions and that, unfortunately, sometimes civilians die, but that's neither the intention nor the foreseeable result. In fact, as I write in War Made Invisible, and this is simply one other layer of the invisibility of U.S. wars to the U.S. public, what's done in our names with our tax dollars, the predictable effects of U.S. wars have been to kill civilians on a regular basis. The so-called war on terror has been characterized by killing civilians directly and indirectly. Brown University's Costs of War Project has done a very conservative estimation that I cite in the book of the toll of the so-called war on terror since October of 2001. And it's pretty close to 400,000 civilians directly killed and a total of about 950,000 directly killed. I emphasize directly because the project points out that for every death that is directly attributable to this, quote, war on terror, there have been several indirect deaths, destruction of infrastructure, environment, housing, healthcare, you name it. So we're looking at several million people who've died in ostensible response to the crime of 9/11 that killed 3,000. How can that be? Of course, it's profitable. Of course, the propaganda system is in overdrive 24/7, 365 to tell us that while the U.S. makes mistakes and errors, that somehow it is all for the global good. One rationale, which is tacit or explicit, is that the Pentagon never intends to kill civilians. It just happens unfortunately. And there are a lot of layers of that, which I write about in the book. One is, to take an example, when Dick Cheney went to the floor of the House 18 months ago to support his daughter for opposing Trump, the Democratic leader, Nancy Pelosi, publicly proclaimed that they were honored to have Dick Cheney visit the House floor. You're honored to have a war criminal. Well, I mean, if Putin is a war criminal, and he is, so is Dick Cheney, and so is George W. Bush. I can't find a single editorial from a major newspaper that routinely calls Putin a war criminal using that description for Cheney or Bush. And given a lot that is in evidence, it could at least arguably be attached to our last few presidents since George W. Bush as well. I use the analogy, and given how predictable this death toll has been and continues to be with the U.S. involved in military actions directly in Syria, in Somalia, a lot of special ops we're not even told about. What does it mean to say these killings were not intentional? Let's think about that. After 9/11, essentially, Congress and the president gave the United States government a political license to kill whenever and wherever it chose necessary to work its will on the world. But let's say in Boston or San Francisco or any other city or town in the United States, the authorities, the armed police, decided that when they're going to chase criminals and they think the criminals might be in a store or in a home or in some other facility, a school, that the authorities used firepower to spray the plate glass windows with machine gun fire, drop bombs occasionally. And of course, there'd be many civilians killed, and yet the pretense could always be, oh, that was a mistake. We didn't mean to do that. Well, how would that go over? The do as we say, not as we do precept is very powerful, but it's tacit, it's unspoken. And that certainly applies to the geopolitical conflicts that we're struggling with right now, whether the group is Roots Action or Massachusetts Peace Action or many other hundreds of groups or thousands are in some way having to encounter a political terrain that deals with the aggression of Russia on Ukraine. And there's no justification for what Russia's doing. There is an explanation. And if we were to assume that the United States doesn't have the prerogative, and this would be a leap of imagination for most mass media in the United States, if we're to assume that the United States doesn't have the prerogative to do whatever it wants and then preach to the rest of the world something else, then they're very simple tests. In Romania and in Poland right now, there are ABM systems, and they're called defensive, but even Radio Free Europe, and I quote in the book, Radio Free Europe reported that those ABM systems can very easily be retrofitted to be offensive missiles. And they're really not far from the Russian border. Of course, Estonia and Latvia, formal members of NATO, are on the Russian border. So let's imagine that Russia, as a nation, a government that is not getting along with the United States, had a military pact with, say, Canada, and put missile systems along the U.S.-Canadian border, the question sort of answers itself. Would the United States government tolerate it? We might only need only remember the Cuban Missile Crisis to get that answer. So the assumption, the precept that is so operative in U.S. media is, and on Capitol Hill, of course, is that the United States should do whatever it can and will to work its will on the world, including militarily, and that when the U.S. can get away with something, it should be able to do it, because after all, when we make mistakes, we make mistakes, but the intentions are good. If you go back in the archives, you can find the only one of two members of the U.S. Senate voting against the Gulf of Tonkin resolution in 1964, Senator Wayne Morse of Oregon, saying that the United States, he says this explicitly, the United States policy is might makes right. He said out loud what is usually not said out loud. And he even said, it's just as wrong when we do it, in his words, as when the Russians do it, which has a real echo now. There's a, or was a very popular bumper sticker that was red, white, and blue. And it was used by people who felt very much in favor of U.S. warfare. And the bumper sticker, red, white, and blue, says, these colors don't run. And there was a peace group that printed up a red, white, and blue bumper sticker in response. And it said, these colors don't run the world. Well, that's a really difficult concept to sell. to U.S. media, to politicians in Washington, and yet it's absolutely crucial. What goes around comes around. The violence of the 9/11 wars has many ripple effects, including back at home. The COVID pandemic, the climate emergency, in so many ways, the idea that the United States is singularly entitled, singularly virtuous, it doesn't pass the tragic laugh test. And yet it is routine currency, and it's currency that we have to challenge and devalue and insist is not acceptable. One of the big barriers to deconstructing and demolishing this very dangerous set of attitudes is the Republican Party. And another big obstacle is the Democratic Party. I believe there are huge differences between the two parties on domestic policies, and the threat of fascism is very real. At the same time, when you get beyond the water's edge, the attitudes, other than climate policy, for instance, the differences in attitudes shrink almost to the vanishing point. We're facing now a bipartisan militarism of enormous consequence, very little dissent, arguably on Capitol Hill, the discourse and debate is narrower on military and foreign policy than perhaps in any time for decades. And as analysts, as journalists, as activists, as people who do not want to consume history like Wonder Bread off the shelf, we have not only the opportunity, but really a responsibility to inform ourselves and others, to analyze and to organize effectively and directly challenge both outside and inside the lobbying and electoral system. I think overall, when it comes to foreign policy, the relationships between progressives and progressive groups and, say, the leadership and a lot of members of the Progressive Caucus in Congress, I think it's a very unhealthy relationship. Martin Luther King Jr. talked about a phenomenon that he identified with some of the establishment leaders of the civil rights movement during the late 1950s and into the 1960s. He said that these leaders of movements, they are supposed to be a representative of the movement to the establishment. But routinely, they end up being a representative of the establishment to the movements. And that not only is true of some disarmament groups, unfortunately, in some cases, in terms of the U.S. militarism vis-a-vis NATO, includes heavy hitter, funder, and advocacy group like Plowshares. But it's also true, unfortunately, of many members of the leadership of the Congressional Progressive Caucus who have done many wonderful things. They do great advocacy and work on domestic issues, but they're in the military band. They're playing their instruments when it comes to this crisis with Ukraine, which needs diplomacy. And whether it's Massachusetts Peace Action or some other groups, there's been leadership from the grassroots saying, diplomacy cannot be a dirty word in this conflict. And yet, that is the prevailing dominant view that we're dealing with right now, that somehow there has to be a fight to the death without projecting out, what does that mean? What does it mean to say Ukraine must defeat Russia? Well, the silent part was said out loud by uppercase D Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin when he said that the U.S. should weaken the military of Russia. Biden twice said, after the first time his aides tried to, quote, walk it back, Biden as president twice said that there needs to be regime change in Russia. Can you imagine? This is the mentality that we're dealing with. And we're encouraged to believe that there's some shred or dominant effect and attitude of humanity, of humanism, of decency, of regard for human beings in U.S. foreign policy. That's been, I think, in a very specific way refuted by the decision of the Biden administration in the last couple of weeks to send cluster munitions to Ukraine. In War Made Invisible, I devote several pages to war munitions. The United States used 1.2 to 2 million bomblets in its first few weeks of the invasion of Iraq. I think I don't need to emphasize the point of just how inhumane these weapons are, children still picking them up as toys and having their bodies shredded. Well, when, as I point out in the book, Russia invaded Ukraine and from the outset began using cluster munitions, that was rightly, correctly condemned by the White House, by Congress, by US news media. And now in the last few weeks, fast forward almost a year and a half later, when the US is supplying those weapons, those very same weapons to Ukraine, it's A-OK. It's fine. What does that tell us? I think it tells us a couple things, that for the umpteenth example, when you have a willingness of governments to do whatever it can propagandistically to sell its policies at any one time, it's very much like doublethink in 1984. Have a fact or assertion on the shelf, take it off the shelf whenever convenient, utilize it, put it back on the shelf, and then pretend that it doesn't exist. And when we look at the coverage, and I have headlines in the book from the New York Times, where the readers are told in bold headlines, I think I could find it here, where the use of these weapons by Russia is just so horrible. I mean, it just should be condemned. And these were banner front page, all capital headlines of the type we rarely see in the New York Times. So here's a couple of examples. In a chapter titled Over the Horizon, the first day of March 2002, you go to the New York Times homepage and there's a huge headline in capital, all capital letters, Rocket Barrage Kills Civilians. Well, of course, that could have been a headline for the US effects in, say, Afghanistan or Iraq. But no, we didn't have any headlines like that in the New York Times or any other mass media. But we had it when the Russians did what they did. Now, I want to hasten to say that hypocrisy in the US government in no way justifies what Russia is doing, but also what Russia is doing in no way justifies not only US hypocrisy, but the record of killing through so many means, directly and indirectly, hundreds of thousands into the millions of people in this century, as Brown University's cost of War Project has documented, and the almost seamless relationship between US media and the policymakers and ratifiers in Washington. It's so insidious because they keep recycling each other's messaging. I want to give one more example, which I think brings it into focus. 40 days after the Russian invasion began of Ukraine, the New York Times print edition had at the top of the front page, in all capital letters, and I'm quoting here, horror grows over slaughter in Ukraine. Of course, the article under it is all about what Russia is doing. Horror grows over slaughter in Ukraine. Can you imagine a headline in the New York Times in, oh, say, 2003 or any time in years since then about the US military actions in Iraq or Afghanistan? Horror grows over slaughter in Iraq. It just wouldn't happen. It's inconceivable that that would happen. I want to close with one of the main themes of the book that I really felt has gotten really very rare attention and is really crucial. And that is that, as I put it, US policy and media and propaganda have divided humanity into two categories, two sets of people, one of which has grief that really matters, a tier of grief that really matters, Americans, designated allies and people who are at the end of firepower of designated US enemies. And then there's another tier of grief, the unpersons, those whose grief doesn't matter. We don't hear about, we don't get the empathetic coverage or rhetoric about people who are at the other end of US firepower. And that is corrosive. You might, depending on your preferred orientation, call it ethically or morally or spiritually corrosive. Very much so, undermines the very basis, not only of discourse, but you could say just who we are as a society, maybe as people as well. A few of the most important pages of the book, and I'll close with this, comes near the end. It's a set of quotations from Daniel Ellsberg. I sat with him on the deck next to his house in the hills in the Bay Area, the beautiful, looking over the shimmering San Francisco Bay. And Dan spoke in complete paragraphs. There's really no need to edit particularly. And he talked about what happened after 9/11, where the New York Times did an extraordinary journalistic task. They found pictures of virtually all 3,000 of the people who'd been killed on 9/11. And they had a little thumbnail pictures of each one. They had researched, as Dan put it, something that conveyed that they were special humans. They were loved by some people. They, as he said, one liked to skydive, one liked to play golf, one was a musician, a singer, whatever. And then Dan went on to say he thought about what happened during the so-called shock and awe, where the United States, through such an enormous number of destructive firepower into the capital city of Baghdad, you know, size of a city of Atlanta or Houston. And Dan said that, and I think this is a profound point, that the New York Times could have done something very similar after the regime fell in Iraq. The Times could have researched who had died as a result of the US attack, could have found pictures, could have given a little thumbnail narration to present each of those individuals as real people. But as Dan pointed out, it didn't happen. It wouldn't happen. It's unimaginable that it could happen. That's because of the depth of corruption of the propaganda system of the United States.
That was Norman Solomon, author of War Made Invisible: How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. He spoke on July 19, 2023. Thanks to Massachusetts Peace Action for the recording. You can watch the talk, including a very interesting Q&A session on YouTube. Search for Norman Solomon, War Made Invisible. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.